Wednesday, Tay listeners, and welcome back to Tay Learning. My name is Danny.
And I'm Olivia. We are your co-hosts.
This week, we are going to talk about the song Mastermind, continuing our Mental Cages series. Olivia, remind everybody what our Mental Cages miniseries is about.
Absolutely. So if you have not been around for this past season or the season before, first of all, welcome. Second of all, we are doing a miniseries called Mental Cages, where we deep dive and do a little song analysis of Taylor's songs that are associated with mental struggles. We've done Peace, we've done Antihero, we've done The Archer, among others, and there are others that we still will be touching later on. But right now, we are going to focus on Mastermind because, at least in my opinion, this song is full of a lot of darker elements than it might seem on the surface.
I 100% agree. And I also think as we're entering like Tortured Poets season, like this is the last episode before we really, really get into the thick of Tortured Poets content. I think that what we're going to see a lot of in this album, if I had to speculate, and again, I don't know shit. Let's just be clear. I don't know shit. But if I had to guess based on the context clues our girly has been leaving us, I would guess that we are about to get some real tea that's going to dive into the topics that we talk about on Mental Cages. Like, get ready for this miniseries to expand, probably, because I think that she is going to be really vulnerable on this album based on the context clues that she has given us. And I'm super, super excited to just talk about Mastermind today because it's such a grower of a song for me.
Yeah, I feel like on the surface, it's just, it feels kind of quirky and silly almost. But after breaking it down, I'm a lot more intrigued by this song than I was before.
Agreed. And I already found it to be super interesting. So with that being said, we, as always, break this into three parts. We're going to talk about the background of the song. We're going to go through the lyrics and we are going to talk about the critical reception. But before we do any of that, we have to do
housekeeping.
We are here to remind you all.
You can still get your Tipsy Swifties merch on our website, taylearningpodcast.com. Make sure to grab it before it's gone. It will not be available forever. It is a limited time merch.
And honestly, having glassware that says Tipsy Swiftie on it, like your Tipsy Swifties, just a reminder to everyone while you're drinking your wine or taking your shots that you might be tipsy, but you're still a Swiftie. And while you're doing that, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you listen. I cannot emphasize enough how important that is for growing this community and keeping it going strong. When the community is growing bigger, it helps us get our content out on time because honestly, we feel a little bit more responsible for getting it out. And y'all do not let us forget when we are late or miss something. So rate, review, share, the big three.
As always, you can access our official Tay Learning homework playlist linked in the description of this episode. It will have every single song that we mentioned throughout the entire episode for you to listen to before, during, if you want, I guess, or after, whatever you prefer.
And lastly, let's take a quick commercial break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So Mastermind is the 13th track on Midnight. So it came out on October 21st, 2022. It was written and produced by Taylor and Jack Antonoff. No surprises there. And it's an electropop song with synth, vocal harmonies, and one hell of a bass.
When speaking about the inspiration behind Mastermind, Taylor said, quote, "Mastermind is a song that I put last on the album because I'm really proud of it. And I love that when we were making the song, we wanted the verse to sound like romance and sort of like a hero's type of soundtrack. And then we wanted the chorus to sound like a villain has just entered the room. And the idea that you're flipping this narrative and you have been planning and plotting things and making them look like an accident. And I think that's sort of an inside joke between me and my fans is that I tend to do that."
She said that during Midnight's promo, right? So before the Joe Alwyn breakup?
Yeah, that's what I think so. I couldn't find exactly where she said this, but it gives the vibe of Midnight's promo.
You know what's crazy is that in her interview with Sam Lansky, the Time Magazine Person of the Year interview, she said that she was inspired to write that song after watching the 2017 movie Phantom Thread. And Phantom, I know, right? And Phantom Thread is about a haute couture dressmaker who takes a young waitress as his muse. And it's like set in 1950s London or whatever. But we'll talk about this as the episode goes along. I think that Taylor has this habit of taking songs to fit the narrative and her moment of her life where it makes the most sense. And I don't blame her for doing that. We all do that. We take her songs and do that. And she just does it with her own music. But I feel like if this song was written about Joe Alwyn, which I believe that it was, it's so funny how she's kind of like redone the narrative and been like, well, actually, because that's what she does. That's what she does.
See, I think both of those things, it being about Joe Alwyn and being about how she is in general, and that can be taken in any context. I think both of those things are woven throughout the lyrics here.
I think that this song is really, really interesting. I think there's a lot of layers to it, and I'm excited. So I think we should just kind of jump into it.
She opens the song with, "Once upon a time, the planets and the fates and all the stars aligned. You and I ended up in the same room at the same time."
So something immediately interesting about these lyrics is that eagle-eyed fans caught this back when the Lavender Haze music video came out last year. We immediately see her and Joe Alwyn's star signs placed onto a vinyl cover that says Mastermind. I think that's such an interesting little detail, such a cute Easter egg. So there's that.
I agree. And that being an element makes me think that they broke up a little bit later than a lot of people speculate. Like, I think it was post Midnights because this was coming out post Midnights and it still had the green light to come out. So I think that's so interesting, especially with like the idea of stars aligning kind of gives the vibe of this was meant to be, this was meant to happen. This is a magical moment, a divine moment, and you don't have control over a divine moment. They were meant to be together. They were meant to meet at this time. So that's kind of how we're opening this scene that she's trying to portray.
And Taylor explores that narrative a lot when it comes to her and Joe Alwyn. Again, we are assuming that the song is about Joe Alwyn. Putting his star sign seems like it's signed, sealed, delivered. She was dating him when the album came out, we believe. So we're going to say Joe Alwyn for the sake of this episode, right? She explores that narrative a lot with Joe, like Invisible String, talking about how it's fate. They had this single thread of gold that tied them together. And I can't wait. One day, at some point, we're going to break down Invisible String, and I'll talk about how I don't think that it's the Invisible String didn't exist. I just think that, it didn't. The Invisible String existing doesn't mean that it has to exist forever anyway. But she also explores that in All of the Girls You Loved Before, the later vault track of Lover, when she sings the
More
lyrics,
lover.
"More Lover." Your past and mine are parallel lines, stars all aligned, they intertwined.
It's a common metaphor that she tends to use for songs that we do know are about Joe, which is, I'm pretty confident the song's about Joe.
Also, this is the third time that she has opened up a song with the phrase "once upon a time," which I think is super interesting. She did it on "Forever and Always" on "Fearless," and "I Knew You Were Trouble" on "Red." Both of those were pretty angry. They were anger-charged songs. I know, right? Olivia's making a face right now. But and then "Once Upon a Time," the planets and the fates and the stars all aligned. So there's a little bit of suspense there about which way she was going with this. I also think that, we know that "Fearless" had like this fairy tale charged vibe behind it, and "Once Upon a Time" and then "planets, fates, the stars aligned." It's, I don't know, it feels like it's giving Romeo and Juliet to me a little bit, like star-crossed, but also not.
It's a magical moment
Yeah.
in a romance.
And like that same room at the same time, you and I ended up in the same room at the same time. We are assuming that she is referencing the Met Gala. Now, we have our theories about how she and Joe Alwyn might have met before the Met Gala. We haven't done a Joe Alwyn Muses episode. I promise you all it's coming once we know a little bit more. We can't say like anything with confidence at this point in time.
Not yet.
But, we think of Dress, flashback when you met me, your buzz cut, my hair bleached, and we were in the same room at the same time.
She goes on, "And the touch of a hand lit the fuse of a chain reaction of counter moves to assess the equation of you. Checkmate, I couldn't lose."
What song does that lyric immediately remind you of? Because for me, it's Gorgeous. You should think about the consequence of you touching my hand in a darkened room.
You're right.
Immediate, right there. So hands are like so sexy for women. I don't know what it is. It's like the Darcy thing from Pride and Prejudice. We love hands, right? They're so sexy.
We love
And she
the tension.
Yeah,
It's
right?
tension. It's not even just about hands, it's about tension, and hand brushing is tension.
Yes. And she's used that to segue into like very feminine feelings for her entire career. Even on our song, he's got a one hand feel on the steering wheel, the other on my heart. Like she's used that to express tension romantically for her entire career, which I think is super, super interesting.
Yeah, and like this idea of it lighting a fuse, almost like sparks are flying. It's passionate.
Something else that's interesting is when we think about Dear John, she sang the lyrics, "I lived in your chess game, but you changed the rules every day." And then in this song, where she's playing Mastermind or whatever, she says, "Checkmate, I couldn't lose. Hold on, role reversal."
Literally. And for those of you who maybe don't know a lot about chess, that's why you have me. I was on the chess team for one semester in high school, so therefore I am a certified expert. Please hear my sarcasm. I am no expert, but I do know how to play chess.
She
So
does. I can confirm. She tried to teach me.
we just need more time. We just need more time. You'll be good at chess one day. So chess is a game that two people play. You have 16 pieces on a board, and the goal of the game is to get a checkmate. What is checkmate? Well, first we need to understand what check is. So the whole point of chess is you protect your king piece while you capture your opponent's king piece. And check means that you have aligned one of your pieces to threaten the king on the next move. Like the next move, you could take the king. And it's just a plain check if your opponent can either move the king out of your line of sight so you can't capture him on the next move. They take your piece that's threatening the king, or they move one of their pieces in the way of your piece that's threatening the king. A checkmate is when the king can't escape. He's trapped, essentially. There are no other legal moves your opponent can do. Checkmate, and you win the game. So my brain hops to she's trapping him.
Yes, now that the chess lesson is done, that is what we're getting to, is that she is playing a game, a very strategic game here of the chain reaction of counter moves and applying it to Taylor Swift's real life example. Again, we weren't in the room where it happened. We don't know anything that actually happened. But if we're inferring or doing detective work or whatever, and using the part where she says the touch of a hand and the line from Gorgeous, it sounds like he brushed his hand past hers, and it's all she could think about was what was that electric spark that just happened. And because of that, she was like,
Electric touch.
good catch. She was like, I need to make something happen because whatever that was insane. So she had to come up with some sort of a scheme to get his ass
Yeah, and
romantically.
yes. And part of like the strategy to chess, the reason why if you watch people play chess, they'll sit there for several minutes and think and think and think and think and think. It's not because they can't think of a move to make that they can like legally make. It's when they're thinking of a potential move, they think, what is this person going to do in response? And then what am I going to do in response to that? Who's going to come out on top of this move that I'm about to do? And you do that for several different options and you pick the best one. So this whole idea of a chain reaction of counter moves, like what I'm picturing in my head is she gets the little hand brush and she's like, how do I get him to talk to me? What is he going to do if I walk up to him? Okay, he's going to say this, and then I'm going to do this, and then he's going to react like this potentially, and then I'm going to do this. Like she's planning several steps ahead here to get him. And it's really interesting that all of this is happening in the first verse where she opens it up with the planets and the fates and all the stars align. This was meant to be. And then she says to assess the equation of you. Now she's calculating. She's calculating how to force fate to work.
Which is super interesting because Taylor has talked in the past about being accused of being calculated and that is usually reserved for women. But here she is. And you know what? We'll do it. We're going to dive into the chorus. I'm going to have to say the chorus in one big chunk because it all flows and it's all very, very important for the context of the next line. So we're just going to say the chorus real quick. What if I told you none of it was accidental? And the first night that you saw me, nothing was going to stop me. I laid the groundwork, and then, just like clockwork, the dominoes cascaded in a line. What if I told you I'm a mastermind? And now you're mine. It was all by design, because I'm a mastermind. I know that was a lot. I know that was a big chunk, so we're just going to take it piece by piece. What if I told you none of it was accidental? Taylor wildly oscillates between whether or not them meeting and things happening was fate and whether or not she planned things. Because in Paper Rings, she says, I hate accidents, except when we went from friends to this. And then she says, what if I told you none of it was accidental? Which one is it?
Or maybe Paper Rings, her being like, oh, Neil, this was an accident. And now she's finally at a point where she's like, so I'm testing the waters here. What if I told you it wasn't an accident? And what if I was a little crazy? Would you still like me?
Well, the other thing is when she's singing about the decisions that she makes, I saw this wonderful article that talked about how this song has her battling with herself about whether or not the decisions she makes can actually stand up to grand designs of the universe. And she sings about that in Long Story Short. Fatefully, I tried to pick my battles till the battle picked me. So which is it? Can she actually make moves that are going to determine her fate? Or is her fate already written in the stars in this example? And I think, right, again, it depends on what mood she's in, on which one she's going to buy into, and also, frankly, which one feeds the narrative in her head a little bit more at the time.
And I almost wonder, too, if it's like more of these are writing exercises of her trying to figure out if fate is real, or does she have a stronger hand than fate? Like, what does she believe in, ultimately, and her, like, testing out these different scenarios to kind of come to a solution, or I guess a resolution in her head.
Yeah. So that next chunk of, and the first night that you saw me, nothing was going to stop me. So if we're talking about the Met Gala, first of all, if you've been around a while, you know about Olivia's theory that she calls the love square.
It's not
a theory.
It's
called the love square. And the four points of that love square are Taylor Swift, Calvin Harris, Tom Hiddleston, Joe Alwyn. And there's so much that happened in 2016. These timelines just cross. We'll do a love square episode at some point, because after mentioning that, y'all have been messaging and requesting it, but we'll,
yeah,
one day.
There's just a lot of messy overlap around the Met Gala 2016, okay?
That was the party to be at for sure. So we talk about how she knew that nothing was going to stop her, but also she was dating Calvin Harris, but also then she went to go date Tom Hiddleston. It's just so much happened here.
A lot of things were stopping you, Taylor.
Exactly. So how much of this was actually in that moment she was like, oh, I'm going to get that guy, versus just thinking that that guy was hot and being like, if I ever get an opportunity, I totally would. I don't know. I'm not friends with Taylor Swift despite my best efforts.
Or hear me out. Maybe it was her playing her cards the way she was trying to. Like, she was trying to seem cool and not crazy. And he maybe didn't catch the drift that she was interested. She went and had a thing with Tom Hiddleston, realized maybe he was interested, shuffled the deck, and dropped Tom and headed back out there.
Huh.
We don't know.
I don't know. I can't wait to talk about, like, once we get more tea, we might get more tea about their first meeting when
we
hear
Torture
Poets. I don't know. I'm here for the tea, though.
Same.
And then nothing was going to stop me. I laid the groundwork. Whatever the groundwork is, again, I'm super eager. I hope she spills the tea. But, you know, might have just met him. With that viral video of her dancing with Tom Hiddleston, for all we know, that was her trying to get Joe Alwyn's attention. We don't know anything.
Yeah, we don't know anything at all. This is all purely speculation. If you are listening at a point where we know things, don't listen to us.
Yeah, no, we're out here speculating. But just like clockwork, the dominoes cascaded in a line. So right there, she uses a couple of metaphors, very prevalent common metaphors, just like clockwork. So things matching up to a clock of something that she'd planned. And the next line, the dominoes cascaded in a line. Dominoes, if you line them all up and hit one, the rest should go with it. So yeah, what she's trying to say here, from what I can gather, is that she intentionally put pegs up so that if one got knocked, the next one would get knocked, the next one would get knocked. And if we're using the love square example, it's like, well, I'm going to plant a seed with Joe Alwyn. Maybe he'll be single. He's so gorgeous, makes her hate him so much. And then when things with Tom Hiddleston didn't work after they didn't work with Calvin Harris, then it's okay. And then she goes into that dive bar that she likes to reference in Invisible String, All the Wrong Arms That Drag Me to That Dive Bar, in Delicate, Phone Lights Up My Nightstand in the Black, Come Here, You Can Meet Me in the Back. All of these moments are just speckled throughout her songs that say maybe these things were a divine plan, but she was the one with the divine intervention here.
Referencing back to the first verse with chess, like I said earlier, when you play chess, you don't just make one move and then like think about your next one later. You plan the next several moves based off of what you believe will be the counter move from your opponent. And let's be real, like when you are still in the dating scene, trying to talk to someone for the first time, that is absolutely how it feels. What can I say that will make this person react the way that I want them to so that they can get to know me and then get attached? I personally have never experienced like going on a first date, talking to someone for the first time romantically, where it wasn't this strategizing game of how do I keep them interested in me long enough for them to get to know me and give me a chance and for like me to get to know them. And I've never experienced something that wasn't stressful. I don't know if that's just me or.
No, I felt that experience as well. You know, here's Taylor coming in, continuing with, what if I told you I'm a mastermind and now you're mine? It was all by design because I'm a mastermind. Was Taylor a mastermind? I mean, she says in Paris, I want to brainwash you into loving me forever.
Yeah, I feel like the way that this chorus goes of it starting out, what if I told you I'm a mastermind? And then ending with, because I am a mastermind, is her finally getting to the point where she can point blank admit her crazy to him. Like the whole chorus is, what if I told you this? What if I told you none of it was accidental? What if I told you nothing was going to stop me? What if I told you I laid the groundwork? And like watching his reaction as she's saying that and feeling comfortable enough by the end to be like, well, I am a mastermind.
This is also a great time, I think, to talk about this song being about fans too, right? Because, well, I don't think it was written about fans. Long Live wasn't written about fans either. It was written about her band, The Agency, and it was made about fans. So I think that she does this too. We know Taylor loves scheming. She's talked about how much she loves scheming. It was all by design because she's a mastermind. It is always been super important to her to plan things out to keep us more enticed. And she does that with every move that she makes. We talk all the time about her being a two-headed dragon, where one head is musical talent and the other head is marketing genius. So when she makes moves, 9 out of 10 times they're successful because she is a mastermind, because she is playing the long game with her fans.
Yeah, I feel like ultimately this song is about her tendency to do this in general, and her situation with Joe is just the leading example of the song. But I think the song in its entirety is about her being this way.
Which is how it ended up in the Mental Cages series, because it can kind of feel like you're like a manipulative brat or awful person if this is how you plan your life. She says, and I think he knows, I'm an architect, I'm drawing up the plans. Imagine living your life that type A, that planned out. And I'm pretty type A. I live my life pretty planned out. I'm not like this. And I think that does take a toll on Taylor, because it probably feels inauthentic sometimes.
It kind of like brings up the question of, is she like this because she has anxious attachment styles in her relationship, especially with Joe, as we can see through several songs. Verse 2 opens with, you see, all the wisest women had to do it this way, because we were born to be the pawn in every lover's game.
So I find this to be particularly interesting because, as we've talked about throughout this entire episode, she goes back and forth between being somebody who planned things and things that just happened to her. So all the wisest women had to do it this way. What do you mean? Because we have examples in other songs where you're like, well, things kind of just happened. And I'll be honest, I don't think that there is a right way to try to secure a relationship. I know, Olivia, you have your personal example of kind of finessing your way into your current partnership.
I definitely manipulated it. And I tell him point blank, he knows I manipulated it.
Yeah, and it worked out really, really well for you. I think that Taylor is kind of projecting here, in my opinion, a little bit. I think she's trying to reinforce her decision.
Like, normalize it. Like, this is normal. People do this.
She's trying to justify that decision for sure. And I don't think she's wrong that some women do it this way, and that we are born to be a pawn in lovers' games because, you know, women have taken a backseat to men for so long. This definitely has like feminist overtones really strongly. But that being said, I think she's projecting here.
Yeah. Another interesting point I have is another chess reference here. Mm-hmm. The pawn in every lover's game. The pawn is objectively one of the most weak pieces in chess. And at least when I play chess, I use my pawns sacrificially. I will allow them to get taken by the opponent to kind of distract something bigger that I have plotting up.
Good to know.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting that she's saying that like women were traditionally like used as pawns in games of like being thrown around carelessly, and it doesn't matter how things end up happening to the pawn or the woman in the relationship. And it's really interesting to me because in chess, the strongest, most powerful piece is the queen, hands down. The queen has the most power in the whole game, and it's devastating when you lose your queen. If you're trying not to lose your queen, some people sacrifice their queen as a massive distraction, but that's beyond the point. And then the whole idea that like men move women around as pawns and like are the architect of these situations, it's really ironic that the king is so useless and the whole game is revolving around protecting your little useless, defenseless king. It's just ironic.
So the pre-chorus. Next pre-chorus. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Strategy sets the scene for the tale. I'm the wind in our free-flowing sails and the liquor in our cocktails. This is my favorite part of the song, actually. No, lyrically.
Because you relate to it as a type A.
Okay, yes. So the line, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail, is Taylor Swift didn't come up with that, but it's true, right? Like by not having some sort of plan in place, there's a good chance that things are going to fail. This is an interesting one for me though, because relationships are not necessarily something that you should have to plan each move, because human beings are by nature entirely unpredictable. She couldn't have possibly predicted how Joe Alwyn would react to any move that she made. So either she had to have every possible outcome and scenario planned and thereafter planned, which is insane, but if anyone was going to do it, it's Taylor Swift. Or once again, and this is my theory, she's projecting. She's like, things worked out this way because I made them happen this way. And I don't know if I believe that. I mean, she's great. She's not God.
And, you know, even the slightest bit of manipulation and then it working out in your favor makes you feel like you engineered the whole thing. Because, you know, I relate to a sense in this like ideology when I think about my current relationship. Like he was trying not to date anybody. And I was weaving myself in there to the point where if I did leave, he would miss me and he didn't want me to leave, even though he didn't want a relationship. I felt like I finessed that, you know? So even though obviously the whole time I was terrified and questioning everything and worried that it wasn't going to work out, when it did work out in my favor, I was like, yeah, I did that.
Also in the lyrics, I'm the wind in our free-flowing sails and the liquor in our cocktails, is just such a poetic, artsy way to say every single detail was planned by me. Down to our free-flowing sails, the sails that took us where we're at, I planned the wind. I got us on track where we're supposed to go. The liquor in our cocktails, it's not an accident. Those were planned. This was entirely by my design, down to every single detail.
I kind of have this imagery in my head with the liquor in our cocktails as, what does liquor do? It influences you. She was the influence of this whole thing.
Good.
Yeah.
Spicy.
Before we move on to the chorus, I just wanted to make one more little comment here for the line, strategy sets the scene for the tale, and tying it back to the opening of this entire song, once upon a time, the planets and the fates and all the stars aligned. Sounds like a fairy tale, right? Mm-hmm. She's saying that strategy is actually what sets up the romantic fairy tale. Without the strategy, you're not going to get that tale. I think kind of ties it all together nicely.
So the chorus repeats itself other than one quick lyric change. So what if I told you none of it was accidental, and the first night that you saw me, I knew I wanted your body. I laid the groundwork, then just like clockwork, dominoes cascaded in a line. What if I told you I'm a mastermind, and now you're mine? It was all my design. Because I'm a mastermind. So first of all, because I think it's funny, we got a misheard lyric submission after our misheard lyrics episode came out. Somebody messaged me and said that they thought that the lyric was, I knew I wanted you, buddy. So now I can't unhear it. I knew I wanted you, buddy.
I hate it. That's so funny.
I hate it too. And now I will never unhear it. So thank you so much. You know who you are for submitting that. That would have been so funny while we were drunk.
I knew I wanted you, buddy.
Absolutely ridiculous.
I feel like the lyric changes are her taking more ownership of how it actually went down, because like, nothing was going to stop me from making you mine sounds so romantic, and then saying it was all by design is just kind of distancing from what happened in her brain, like how she manipulated it. But her saying point blank, I knew I wanted your body, is so much more explicit and raw than just, oh yeah, I knew we were going to be together forever. Like it was more realistic, right? Like this is how I felt exactly in that moment. It's more honest. And then it was all my design is like, yes, I did this.
Not this was my design, plan. Yeah.
Like, it's mine.
I like that. Yeah. Like, I like what you just said a minute ago about how at the beginning it's all like the planets and the fates. And then it was strategy. So like the song becomes increasingly darker.
Yeah, because she's starting to become, it's like word vomit. She's like having this conversation with him. And like, I think it all ties together by the end too. Like, I picture this as a conversation of, this is how it actually happened when we met, because I was crazy. This is what I did. This is what happened. And as this conversation is going, she's getting more and more comfortable and just word vomiting about how her brain actually works with situations like this.
And I think you're right, because she cracks open during this bridge, fully opens up.
In the bridge, she says, "No one wanted to play with me as a little kid, so I've been scheming like a criminal ever since to make them love me and make it seem effortless. This is the first time I've felt the need to confess, and I swear I'm only cryptic and Machiavellian because I care."
Wow. Okay. So this is the part that's going to need the most unpacking, like most Taylor Swift bridges, right? And I think that something that we haven't totally talked about on this podcast, because we haven't talked about a whole lot of debut songs, is that Taylor Swift has been such a victim of bullying in her life, which sounds so crazy. Like, again, we don't need to pity a billionaire. We don't need to pity Taylor Swift. She doesn't need our pity. She is a very strong, powerful woman now. But when she was younger, things were tough for her, right? Very tough for her when she was a kid. And she talks about this here in that first line, "No one wanted to play with me as a little kid." And I have some quotes for y'all. In a 2019 interview with Elle magazine, so firmly Lover era, Taylor said, quote, "Never being popular as a kid was always an insecurity for me. Even as an adult, I still have recurring flashbacks of sitting at lunch tables alone or hiding in a bathroom stall or trying to make a new friend and being laughed at. In my 20s, I found myself surrounded by girls who wanted to be my friend. So I shouted it from the rooftops, posted pictures, and celebrated my newfound acceptance into a sisterhood without realizing that other people might still feel the way I did when I felt so alone."
You're on your own, kid.
You always have been. She also, in her speech at NYU in 2022, still an amazing speech to this day. I remember the day that came out, we were so shook. She says in the speech, quote, "Not being invited to the parties and sleepovers in my hometown made me feel hopelessly alone. But because I felt alone, I would sit in my room and write the songs that would get me a ticket somewhere else."
That's rough. I agree with you that, like, we don't need to pity Taylor because she's okay now. But I think that having empathy for her younger self is totally acceptable and warranted.
I agree. And even in some of her earliest songs, she talks about it, like in The Best Day, "I'm 13 now. I don't know how my friends could be so mean. I don't know who I'm going to talk to now at school." The song The Outside, that's one of my favorite songs on debut, totally underrated. I stand by it. And The Outside is all about nobody wanting to let her in, even though she just wants a group of friends. And I totally feel that. I was from a small school in Kansas. Like, I couldn't be picky with my friends. That's just the way that it was. I get that. And in her poem from 2017, "If You're Anything Like Me," she also wrote, "No amount of friends at 25 will fill the empty seats at the lunch tables of your past, the teams that picked you last." That shit always messes me up. So what we're seeing here, that was a lot of context, but basically to say, it seems like she's getting at, from my perspective, is that when no one wanted to be her friend when she was younger, she decided, "I'm going to take the narrative into my own hands. So if people don't want to be my friend, if people don't want me around, I can either sit down and take it, or I can become scheming and manipulative and Machiavellian." But we'll talk about Machiavelli in a minute.
The later line of, "I've been scheming like a criminal ever since to make them love me and make it seem effortless." I feel like them can be so many different people in her life. Who's them? Is it her fans? Is it her peers in the music industry? Was it her friends in high school? She tried really hard to like scheme and plot so she could have some friends in high school. Her past romantic relationships. Who is them? It's very vague.
I've always heard that line, even though I feel like the rest of the song is about Joel, and I've always heard that line as fans, "to make them love me and make it seem effortless." I feel like this is such a vulnerable moment of being like, from Taylor's perspective, "I'm so insecure because of the empty lunch tables of my past, that as a result, being loved by the masses is the thing that fuels me." Which she said before, she said in Miss Americana, the people enter the entertainment industry because they are intrinsically insecure. And I think that that's true for Taylor. Like, she opened up about that. So we're pretty sure that this is true for Taylor and she wasn't lying. And as a result, she needs to be manipulative so that she can have these friends. When she says, "This is the first time I felt the need to confess," I think that that's so telling because that's why I think that it's about fans. Like, this is the first time I feel the need to confess. It doesn't seem to me like she's talking to a lover. It feels like in that moment, she's saying, hey, reminder to all of you, you're here. I've got you now. Just letting you know I've got you.
Because I'm a mastermind.
Let's talk about Machiavelli because, okay, this is just like a mini Danny Lore moment. In 2016, I was like, I don't know, quasi seeing this dude. And he told me, he's like, I think I'm like Machiavelli. And I don't know why I didn't see that as the fattest red flag that a guy's ever waved in my fucking face, but it is. Don't date Machiavelli. Don't kiss Machiavelli. Don't look at Machiavelli. I think he even tweeted that when I was like 20. I was so pissed. But the reason that that's a problem is because Machiavelli is an Italian philosopher and he was a nightmare human by pretty much all accounts, but he was cunning, he was scheming, he was a mastermind, right? And he also has an incredibly famous quote that I'm certain you have heard: the end justifies the means. What it feels like Taylor is saying here by specifically name dropping Machiavelli instead of just saying, oh, I'm a mastermind, and no, it's one and the same, right? Is that the ends justify the means in this instance and in all instances means it doesn't matter what you do during the process as long as you get what you want.
All's well that ends well to end up with you.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yep. So it's not, she could have just said, I'm a mastermind, like cunning, witty, clever, scheming. That's all Machiavellian traits. But she didn't just say those words. She said him specifically because the ends justify the means. Great catch there. Whoa.
And to steer things kind of a little bit darker, even. So, Machiavellianism is a term in psychology used to describe a certain personality trait. This personality trait, called Machiavellianism, is considered in the dark triad alongside psychopathy and narcissism. I have my trusty Wikipedia pull up here to read you the definition of Machiavellianism. It's the name of a personality trait characterized by interpersonal manipulation, indifference to morality, lack of empathy, and a strategic focus on self-interest. Those who score high on the scale for Machiavellianism are more likely to have a high level of manipulativeness, deceitfulness, and a cynical, unemotional temperament. This is getting like really dark. Like, she just threw this into this cute little song that she has like performing on the Eras tour, where her dancers are in a clock and she's whatever. And I think that pulling this in to this line specifically and following it up with, 'cause I care. Machiavellianism is defined by not caring about anyone but you. So it's just an interesting lyric there, and really shows how low she thinks of herself in her dark moments if she is comparing herself to this.
Yeah, like that's how we ended up in the mental cages here with this one is that her self-image, think about what Olivia just said, psychopathy, narcissism, those are a lot more popular when we talk about than Machiavellianism. They all are an evil, what do you call it, the evil triangle or
The
something?
dark triad.
The dark triad, that's a way sicker way to say
Right?
evil triangle. No, the dark triad.
The evil triangle.
Evil triangle. So it's so interesting that that's how she sees herself. And then to say, because I care. Interesting here.
If you were really Machiavellian, you wouldn't care.
Yeah. And she sings it like with such a lighthearted attitude. I'm only cryptic and Machiavellian because I care. Like she's not telling us, hey, I'm a narcissistic psycho. And I don't think that she is. But she, at least in her darker moments, thinks that she is, especially like you said earlier, if somebody has like one moment of manipulation to make dominoes cascade in a line, they might feel inclined to take credit for all of it. But that goes for positive and negative, right? Because if
Yeah.
everything works out the way it's supposed to, or not supposed to, because that means divine intervention, but works out in a way that's positive, it's like, I did that. But if things work out negatively, it's, I did that.
And, you know, if this is a tendency of hers, there's likelihood that things have spiraled out of control. Like when she's saying the lyric, I try to pick the battles till the battles picked me, she was trying to mastermind that and it turned to shit. You know, so like she felt like that was her fault because she tried to have a hand in it to manipulate it the right way and it had the opposite effect. So it's just very interesting, especially because like I hear the 'cause I care lyric as like a desperate cry. Like, I care. Like, can't you guys see I care? Like, this is the dark point of the song for sure.
And then she wraps it up with a, again, slightly changed chorus. So I told you none of it was accidental. And the first night that you saw me, nothing was going to stop me. I laid the groundwork and then saw a wide smirk on your face. You knew the entire time. You knew that I'm a mastermind. And now you're mine. Yeah, all you did was smile, because I'm a mastermind. And that wraps the song. And here's where my head thinks it's, oh, like it's Joe Alwyn. It's also fans. I don't really know which one it was, because she will say, like, at her concerts, like, it's my love language for you, about Easter eggs and about me teasing stuff, blah, 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 and you all love it. And I'm like, oh, this is fans coded. But then I think Cruel Summer, he looks up grinning like a devil, saw a wide smirk. He knew she was a manipulator, a mastermind here, and he didn't care. But is she actually masterminding or manipulating if he knows it's happening? Or I don't know. Right. Contradicting.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I guess like in my brain, this last chorus is still this conversation with presumably Joe, but it has extra layers there, you know, like extra applications, I guess, because I think it kind of goes straight in a line of her being like, you know, what if I told you? And then when she finally broke and had her bridge moment where she let us and him know all this information about why she is like she is, then she took full 100% ownership of the entire course. So I told you, the first night that you saw me, nothing was going to stop me. I laid the groundwork. And in the middle of like explaining, this is what I actually did to make you mine, the reaction was surprising to her because it was positive, not, wow, you're crazy, I need to get away from you, which maybe she had experienced at some point in time before. If this is a common thing that she does in her life, I'm sure like someone out there has not appreciated or liked it. And so it was surprising to her that she was met with such like a positive reaction. And I feel like the song at this point too takes like a really positive romantic spin sonically. Like it sounds so relieved at the end.
Yeah, all you did was smile because I'm a mastermind. And then it closes out. I want to read you this excerpt from this, again, incredible Time article about this song. The article ends with, so which version of Taylor is the real one? The try-hard desperate for our approval, or the Machiavellian schemer who's had us in her pocket the whole time? Which three-syllable M-word is a more apt metaphor for her career? Luckily, we don't need a definitive answer. We love Taylor precisely because she can so believably and fully embody both ends of the emotional spectrum, that she can be the scorned lover or the heartbreaker, the archer or the prey. In this last chorus, Taylor actually pokes a hole in her airtight and individualist scheming. While she had anticipated her success to be a one-woman job, the subject of the song was a willing accomplice the whole time.
Man, you know, I sometimes will overanalyze Taylor Swift songs and her career in general. And sometimes I do get caught up in, is she playing us? Do we really know her? And then being torn with like having this parasocial relationship with her where I'm like, no, no, no. Of course it's real. So I totally like relate to that whole question of, so what is she like? Because we don't know her at the end of the day, right? But I think my ultimate conclusion here, you know, obviously I have a Taylor Swift podcast. I think you know the answer. I think that she's very, very hard on herself.
Yeah.
And very overcritical of the intention behind her actions of, am I actually a good person or am I a bad person? Even though I'm doing good things.
Well, this is one of my favorite things to talk about, is the question of, if you are doing good things to be perceived as a good person, are you still a good person? Because some people, more philosophers, would say yes. Some more philosophers would say no. But yeah, at the end of the day, it produces the same good. So there's just so many layers to this. I am so, so, so obsessed with that entire moral philosophy question. And I think Taylor herself has those own qualms of, am I doing this to be good? Or because I am good, I want to be seen as a good girl. It's a whole thing. And is this song in particular self-congratulatory? Yes, but I think she's earned it.
Yeah, like we said in the very beginning of this episode, this song sounds a lot more simple on the surface, but there's a lot she has going on here in her psyche about analyzing her past and how she does things. So that is why it's included in the Mental Cages series.
All right. So those are all of the lyrics. So lastly, as we always do, we're going to talk about the reception. Now, here's the thing. Midnights, absolutely slayed the house boots down when it came to the charts. So Mastermind didn't need to be released as this crazy single, which it wasn't, to end up on Billboard lists, to end up in the top 20 singles charts in multiple countries, to end up charting all over the Billboard Hot 100. It received certifications in Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom. It was beloved because all of Midnight's was beloved. I think the only thing that can knock Midnight's off is Tortured Poets incoming, right? Maybe. We'll see. Music critics really loved Mastermind. Although when we first listened to Mastermind, I think you really liked it. I felt very mid about it.
I liked it because of my direct connection, the direct relatability for me, but it quickly fell in my ranks as time went on.
Or rather, as we like to say, other things just rose.
You know, yes.
I know.
Yes. I think that's way more valid, honestly.
And, you know, Taylor must love this song and feel very strongly about it, too, because she put it on the Eras Tour set list, which she had to be choosy about, despite it being like a 3.5 hour show. Critics called Mastermind a highlight on the album, praising its intricate rhythm, fairy tale lyrics that also turn into manipulative lyrics, how the perspective shifts throughout the song, like we were talking about. One critic called it a luxuriously sexual and clever song, which I think is interesting. I know, right?
I wanted your body sexual.
Sexy, right? striking lyricism. Some people said that it sounded more defensive and reactive, and it was compared to, like, Look What You Made Me Do in Bitterness, which I found interesting. I just think that there's misogyny in a lot of these reviews. Not that every criticism of Taylor is misogyny. It's not. It's not. But, like, in this instance, her being self-congratulatory doesn't mean that she hasn't earned it, in my opinion. And it also doesn't mean that it's not true. It's confessional. That's why it's in the Mental Cages series. This isn't her being like, everyone's against me, but it's just because I'm a mastermind. Like, that's not what's happening here.
Good. This is on Midnights. This was a sleepless night. This was a hard time that she had about something, like, whatever.
But my favorite review did say that the song was both ornately constructed and brilliantly self-effacing. She did a great job here, oscillating between those two feelings. Just like that Time article said, which is it? Is she a Machiavellian mastermind? Or is her life happenstance and she just reaps the benefits? I think it's kind of both, depending on the scenario. Yeah. But it is interesting how she has songs like Invisible String, which are all like, oh, fate. And the song, which is like, fuck fate, man. I'm fate. I'm God.
I'm fate.
I am inevitable. Snap.
Watch this.
So that's Mastermind.
I'm so glad we did this. I say this after every single song analysis, but it's never not true. I just appreciate songs so much more when we deep dive them, and it stays that way, like, going forward forever. Like, every song we've ever analyzed, I'm like, oh, I get it now.
What did you say learn this week?
I think my biggest takeaway is I never really broke down her Machiavellian reference, and I didn't realize how dark it makes the song, actually.
Yeah.
And for such, like, a song that sounds so lighthearted on the surface, that's a really dark twisted turn.
Yeah.
What did you, Tay, learn?
I think my favorite thing I, Tay, learned was something that you'd said that I've referenced, is the oscillation in the song, but starting off with her being like, the planets and the fates, and oh, it would just happen cosmically, to ha ha, joke's on you, I did it. I aligned the stars. And, like, it's slow, her, like, taking ownership of that as the song goes on. I've never really thought about it that hard.
Yeah. And it happens, like, slowly too. You get a little bit more each stanza.
Piece by piece.
She's such a good lyricist. I don't care what anyone says.
What are we talking about next week?
Oh my gosh. I can't wait for next week, because you know what's coming out next week? The Tortured Poets Department.
Bum, bum, bum.
Catch us next Wednesday for your official pregame for TTPD, where Danny and I will be speculating on what theme of all the songs are going to be, what they're going to sound like. You know we're always wrong, so listen before and listen after for your enjoyment.
I can't even go back and listen to the ones we've done in the past. I get so horribly embarrassed. Fun. I know you love it. I get such secondhand embarrassment for myself. I just got to listen before and then never think about it again.
Sometimes we're pretty accurate. Like, our 1989 vault predictions, we, like, at least guessed the vibe of the song, like how the lyrics were going to relatively go. We did a good job. At least
good
I think
hear.
In my memory.
Good to hear. I'm not going to go back and listen though.
Midnight's is more embarrassing, but we were also drunk for that episode. So
our first ever
worse.
Tipsy Swifties, yeah. Which is a reminder that you can go to our website, taylearningpodcast.com, to buy your Tipsy Swifties merch for a limited time, right? You might want some wine when you're in your Tortured Poets era, and you might want to drink out of a Tipsy Swifties glass. While you're on our site, we have more information about our podcast. You can contact us through a contact form, or if you're not feeling like contacting us that way, you can send us an email, taylearningpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at Tay Learning and on Instagram and TikTok at Tay Learning Podcast.
Yay, I can't wait for Tortured Poets season.
Ah!
Tortured Poets era, it's the season too. Tis the damn season.
Tis the damn Tortured. I just can't imagine being, I'm in my Tortured Poets era. What?
Tis the damn Tortured Poets season.
Tis the damn Tortured Poets season. All right. Well, with that, we hope you all are very excited for just some back-to-back-to-back Tortured Poets content.
I can't believe we're about to get it so soon, honestly. Like, every time new Taylor Swift music is about to drop, I just cannot conceptualize what new Taylor Swift music sounds like.
No.
This could be new lore.
You could get a new favorite Taylor Swift song at any given time. That's possible.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
See y'all next week.
See you next week.
I'm sorry, I hiccuped. Oh, God. No, no, no.
Are you about to go throw up?
No, no. I don't want to get the hiccups, though. If I was going to have a hangover puke, it was going to be 9 hours ago.
This isn't the Tipsy Swifties.
Okay. Okay, we're good. I just didn't want to get the hiccups. Like, we're wrapping up. Getting hiccups right now would fucking suck. All right?
You get hiccups bad.
Yeah. I get them like 3 or 4 times a week.
That's crazy. That's a lot.
It is, because I can't burp. And I can't release gas. So that is my body trying to release gas. I figured all this out. All right. There's actually a name for it. Can't remember it. So
that sucks. I'm so sorry.
Such is life.